Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Times reporter Kate Zernike on the Tea Party.
The mistake people make is looking at the rallies and looking at some of the more outrageous signs and thinking that that's all it is, that everyone is sort of that nuts.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Sam Roberts discusses new findings in the Rosenberg-Adam spy case.
I think we can stipulate the defensive perimeter around the Rosenbergs keeps narrowing as more information comes out.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. That's all coming up next after the break.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, and by Ford and voice-activated sync, the in-car connectivity system that features hands-free calling.
Anyone who's been reading the New York Times knows that our great national correspondent Kate Zernike has become the maestro of the Tea Party movement in the United States, and she's put a lot of her reporting and some new thoughts and insights into an important new book. It's called Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America. It's reviewed for us by the historian Alan Brinkley, who says Zernike's illuminating book gives a picture of how different some Tea Partiers are from the Republican establishment's view of the movement. I'm delighted that Kate is here to talk about her book. Hi, Kate.
Thanks, Sam.
So you've seen the Tea Party everywhere. Talk about some of the places you've been to, some of the events and people you've met.
Well, it's interesting. I was just talking to someone on the train coming in from New Jersey this morning, and people don't believe it, but we see it. You know, I see it in my own hometown in New Jersey. My first Tea Party event was in South Dakota, and I think most people sort of assume that it's kind of limited to South Dakota or maybe off the grid Idaho. But I have seen it in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. I have been to tea parties, obviously, in Washington, D.C., in Elkhart, Indiana, which is record unemployment. That's the RV capital of the world. So really, it's across the country. I mean, it's Pasadena, California. It's cities hit hard by unemployment in the Midwest. And it's on the East Coast where taxes are very high and people are upset about it.
You've mentioned taxes. What are they boiling mad about?
Well, that's often hard to, you know, I say in the book, it's like the blind man and the elephant. It sort of depends on where you're standing. But I think it's actually, it's, you know, in some ways, it's unfortunate that they took the Tea Party name because people sort of assumed, oh, like the original Boston Tea Party, this was about taxes. And in many ways, I think it's broader than that. I think it's sort of, you know, I say the rallying cry of this movement is really leave us alone. They just have the sense that government is too much in their lives. They want it out. It's not always maybe sort of clear cut what they're trying to, what they would like to get rid of. But I think they've sort of settled on some libertarian ideas like we should be very strict about having the federal government do only what's in the Constitution, which is about a list of, you know, 22 things. So they want to get rid of all sorts of departments. But I think in general, they're angry at the federal government. They're angry at the sense that government is too much in their lives. And they feel like they have worked hard to become part of the middle class. And they want to hang on to more of their money. It's not just about taxes. It's sort of this feeling that too much of what they have worked hard for is going to other people who haven't worked hard for it.
Have you met Tea Partiers that you think of as friends or people you really like a lot and connect with? Or do you feel you're an anthropologist looking at some foreign species?
Well, a little of both. You know, we had a party for the book a couple of weeks ago in Manhattan, and some of the Tea Partiers from Bucks County came, and they all were joking me. They said, oh, you know, you and your fancy Manhattan friends, we're going to come to your book party at Elaine's, and, you know. So you can debate whether Elaine is herself a Tea Partier. So they came and they, you know, talked to my New York Times colleagues and everyone got along, much to everyone's surprise. But look, they're not monsters. These people, I don't think, you know, this is 18% of Americans we're talking about. I don't think anyone would think that 18% of Americans are monsters. So yes, there are certainly people who look a lot like your neighbors. And as I said, you know, if you go to some local meetings in your own town, maybe on the East Coast, wherever, I think people will find that what they're hearing is not so different. I think the mistake people make is looking at the rallies and looking at some of the more outrageous signs and thinking that that's all it is and that everyone is sort of that nuts. And, you know, yes, the signs say some outrageous things, but when you sit down and talk to people, their concerns don't seem that out of line in many cases.
And are they right about some things? Or do they have a real case to make?
Well, I mean, I think where it is easiest to understand what they are talking about is the Tea Party movement comes out of the sense that we were in the stimulus and in the bailout spendings, we were spending money that we didn't have, and we had this huge, enormous debt, and how could this be? And I think maybe people who were in charge of the economy, in the administration, did not
make—
In the Obama administration, did not make enough of an effort to explain to people the successes of the stimulus, why we needed to spend the stimulus money. I think it was very esoteric to a lot of people, which is understandable. This is complicated stuff even to economists. So I think it is easy to understand their frustration because, look, the future feels very uncertain. The economy feels very uncertain. This is in many ways an anxious reaction to that.
Kate, one of the strengths of your book is the historical context you bring to the Tea Party. Help me and our listeners understand what some earlier similar examples of this kind of protest politics might be.
Well, I think it's remarkable to me when you look at, you know, old films or you read about the Goldwater Movement in 1964, how that ferment, which really does sort of start around people's kitchen tables in California and sort of the Sun Belt states, how that sounds a lot like the Tea Party in the same ways. I mean, when Rand Paul, who's the Senate candidate, the Tea Party, you know, sort of the ultimate Tea Party candidate for Senate in Kentucky, when he talked about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and how he didn't think on principle that that was something that the government should have done, was that government should not be forcing businesses to serve blacks, he got in enormous trouble. Goldwater got in trouble for the same thing. It's sort of this purist libertarian stand, and I think that a lot of the Tea Party people have embraced. So that's one of it. But it's also other things. It's the anti-tax movements of the 70s and early 80s, again, starting in California. It's some of the things that you and I have talked about, the textbook protests in West Virginia in the 70s, busing even in the 70s. I mean, one of the amazing things I think in the book is if you look at the poll that the New York Times did in April of 2010 and compare it to similar studies that were done in 1974 and 1975, how similar people look, just sort of their attitudes about patriotism, about you know, patriotism or lack of patriotism in this country, their concerns about the economy. We've heard these things over and over again. So in many ways, people look at the Tea Party and think, oh, this is just a reaction to Obama or a reaction to a black president. The reality is we have seen this over and over again. And of course, we saw opposition to health care reform with Bill Clinton. And right now, I think as the Tea Party has evolved, opposition to health care has been a huge driving force toward it. It was opposition to health care reform, I should say.
Now, let's look ahead, Kate. We have elections coming up. Tea Party has exerted considerable influence, at least within the Republican Party. Are there legitimate, like self-identified Tea Party politicians who can govern this country or help govern it?
We have a lot of Tea Party candidates. It turns out that most of the Tea Party candidates are in districts where the demographics are just stacked against them. They're running in, you know, heavily blue districts. So we're not going to see as many Tea Party candidates as we might think. That said, there are a lot of prominent Tea Party candidates. I think it is very hard, if not impossible, to govern on a Tea Party agenda because, look, a purist view of the Constitution is the late 18th century. I mean, it's impossible. Things have changed so much, and the Constitution has evolved. I mean, even most constitutional scholars will acknowledge that. The view of the Constitution is trying to deny about 150 years of history, which, of course, is not very practical. So I think it's very hard to govern on a Tea Party agenda. The other thing is, you know, their view is that the New Deal was the worst thing that's ever happened in American history, that FDR was a terrible president. Everything the federal government has done since then is not in the proper constitutional role of Congress. Not in its purview. So, I mean, to reverse 80 years of history is crazy. So I think it's very hard. Things like Social Security and Medicare, which they think we should be phasing out, those are not very popular thoughts among Americans.
Thanks a lot, Kate.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Kate Zernike, whose new book, Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field, a somewhat breathless Julie Bosman because she's back from a big event. What's going on, Julie?
Well, today was the announcement of the new Nobel Prize winner for literature. And the Nobel Committee has chosen Mario Vargas Llosa, the writer from Peru. And he appeared this afternoon in Manhattan at a press conference. He's spending the semester teaching Latin American studies at Princeton University. So
lucky for them.
Yes.
So you were there. Was it a big to do? Was this a surprise? I mean, Vargas Llosa is one of the great living novelists, author of Aunt Julian, the scriptwriter, and many other contemporary classics, a recent retelling of Madame Bovary that was reviewed on the cover of the book review, major figure. Were people expecting it? Was there a short list with his name on it?
There is always a short list for who might win the Nobel, and it's reliably unreliable. There are all these betting sites and people who are apparently close to the Swedish Academy like to guess who's going to win. And checking the night before the prize was announced, there were a few late-breaking contenders, including Cormac McCarthy, Joyce Carol Oates, who I think is on the short list every year.
And was Vargas Llosa on that list? Did you see his name floating around?
His name was not floating around. So it was a bit of a surprise. And in recent years, the Academy has picked many Europeans. And the last South American to win the prize was Gabriel Marcia Marquez, who won in 1982.
And in a way, they're complementary artists in some sense. Magical realism and novelists who really have elevated and transformed the novel in recent years. What was Vargas Llosa like in the flesh when you saw him?
Well, it was quite a scene at the press conference. There were at least 150 people crammed into a room. I counted at least 35 television cameras, and it didn't seem like there were many people there who didn't speak Spanish. And there was a real excitement when he walked into the room. He was mobbed by cameras, microphones, very giddy journalists, and he struck a very cool figure. He came in wearing a gray suit. He has this very thick mane of silver hair, and one of the rare intellectuals with movie star looks. A very
Julie, elegant guy. You're getting carried away here. So he's a very glamorous figure. Also a political figure, is that right? Did
yes.
he run for president?
He ran for president in 1990 in Peru. It was a brief, semi-comic adventure, and it did not work out, needless to say. But he's still somewhat of a controversial figure in his home country. There were some very vehement reaction this afternoon from South America, varying reaction, actually. I mean, in his native Peru, members of Congress took to the floor to praise him, but there was also some criticism. So his what are considered conservative views in Peru and South America still remain controversial.
Right. And just so our listeners understand, to be conservative in Peru is kind of like being conservative at Harvard Yard. It's not necessarily to be a Tea Party candidate.
Right. It's to oppose dictators or communism.
Now, Julie, who is his publisher here? At one point, it was Farrar, Straus & Giroux. So what do they do when suddenly they've struck gold?
I believe another publisher, several publishers, Picador Press announced today that they were going to release 10 of his novels or re-release them in paperback.
So 10 novels. This is a really prolific and consequential novelist.
He's written more than 30 novels, plays, essays. He used to be a newspaper writer. He's had a very interesting career, but I'm sure this will have a lot of people running to the bookstores or Amazon to try to get more of his work. Literary news gets a ton of attention, so I think everyone sees this as a good thing.
Well, we know you can't take your eyes off him, Julie. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sam.
Coming up after the break, The Times' Sam Roberts fills us in on the latest developments in the Rosenberg spy case.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Glass Room by Simon Maw. Maw's latest novel is the story of a young Jewish couple in 1930s Czechoslovakia. It combines struggle and faith in a way the Washington Post describes as eerily erotic and tremendously exciting. That's The Glass Room, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. This book review podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features hands-free calling. Just say the name of the person you want to call, and Sync dials the number. With Sync, you'll never miss a call, and you can keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel. Sync is subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
The Rosenbergs, they were executed long ago, but they remain important figures and their story, one of the most riveting in modern American history. And who better to write about it than my colleague Sam Roberts, the author himself of The Brother, The Untold Story of the Rosenberg Case. And this week, he reviews two new books on the case and is here to talk about it. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you.
All right, let's do the books in order. First, we have Final Verdict, What Really Happened in the Rosenberg Case by Walter Schneer. Why is it important that Schneer has written about the case? Where does he stand in all of this?
Well, Walter Schneer wrote a book years ago that was also a final verdict on the case, that the Rosenbergs were framed, that they were punished for a crime that never occurred. And now he's revisiting that case because so much new evidence has come out since then and that clearly implicates Julius Rosenberg. And his conclusion is that David Greenglass, who was the brother, Ethel Rosenberg's brother, whose testimony sent both Ethel and Julius to the electric chair, was motivated by something beyond self-aggrandizement, was motivated beyond saving his own skin and that of his wife, that he was actually covering up his own larger role and exaggerating Julius's role. That, in fact, Julius had nothing to do with atomic espionage, according to this latest version.
And what do you think of that?
Well, I think it is not impossible, but I think it's somewhat implausible. And like so much in this case, it's going to have to await verification from Soviet files that haven't been released. It also hardly absolves Julius Rosenberg of espionage per se, whether it was industrial or military espionage that he clearly played a role in.
And what about the second book, The Invisible Harry Gold, The Man Who Gave the Soviets the Atom Bomb by Alan Hornblum?
Well, it's an interesting book because it is a book about Harry Gold, who was the courier. He brought information both from David Greenglass and Klaus Fuchs about the atomic bomb. And he's sort of this Walter Mitty kind of figure, like Greenglass, like, in fact, the Rosenbergs, an ordinary person suddenly thrust into an extraordinary role on a world stage, a role that he really wasn't particularly equipped to perform. Both he and David Greenglass clearly were spies. Both of them insisted they were patriots. Both of them insisted that they hadn't done anything wrong against their country, that they were really aiding the Soviet Union, which was an ally at the time. And both, I think, would never have been prosecuted had they not confessed immediately. They not only confessed and implicated themselves, they went on to implicate others as well.
And what is the latest state of research? You've mentioned Soviet materials we haven't seen yet from the former Soviet Union. What about archival or documentary evidence available in the United States? Is there more for us to see?
There may be some more. I think we have probably seen most of it. There may still be things in FBI files. A lot of that material was released, but some of it redacted, certainly some in perhaps national security agency files or its predecessor agencies. But I think we can stipulate the defensive perimeter around the Rosenbergs keeps narrowing as more information comes out. I think we can certainly stipulate that Julius Rosenberg was a spy, that Ethel Rosenberg was very sympathetic with his aims. She probably wasn't an active spy, but only because she was taking care of the kids and had a bad back. I think if she had been able, she would have been. That they did not steal the secret to the atomic bomb. There was probably no one secret. That the Russians had that information already anyway, but it was confirmatory what they were getting from the Rosenbergs, or certainly from David Greenglass. And the Russians, being as paranoid as we were, confirmation was important to them. And that the only reason, as best I can determine, that Ethel Rosenberg was really indicted was to leverage that indictment against her husband to try and get him to talk. And to me, when I was writing my book, the most telling quote was from Bill Rogers, who was the former Secretary of State at the time of the execution, the Deputy Attorney General. And I asked him, didn't everything work out the way you wanted it to? You indicted the Rosenbergs, you convicted them, you put them to death. And he said, no, Ethel Rosenberg called our bluff. And for him to admit that the government was in effect bluffing when it indicted, convicted and executed Ethel Rosenberg was to me an extremely stunning and cynical statement.
Thanks a lot, Sam. That's Sam Roberts, who this week reviews two new books on the Rosenberg spy case. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on our list this week?
Well, not a great week for Jonathan Franzen. First, a crazed British fan steals his glasses off his face at an event in London and then demands a $100,000 ransom fee. And now Ken Follett, another Brit, has bumped him out of the top spot. Follett's book is called Fall of Giants. It's a family saga set in the early 20th century as contrasted with Franzen's early 21st century family saga. Franzen drops down to number 3, and at number 2 we've got James Patterson back again with another book. This one's called Don't Blink, and it is a bloody thriller that opens with a scene in a New York City steakhouse. Sounds like your average business lunch.
So there's an unexpected connection between Follett and Franzen's novels. Is that right?
Well, one thing I did notice is that Follett's novel actually opens in a scene in the Welsh mining country in 1911. And as you will recall, since you reviewed the book, Franzen's novel has a long section set in the coal mining country of West Virginia. So I guess the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Bring back fossil fuels. What about nonfiction?
Bob Woodward, back at number 1 with Obama's Wars. This is the 16th straight book of his, starting with All the President's Men, to make the list in hardcover. This one, as you've probably read, is sort of an inside view at Obama's decision to send more troops to Afghanistan. And Woodward depicts the administration as riven with suspicion and rivalry, but that's actually kind of a flattering picture compared with the other political books on the list this week. Well, we've got Dinesh D'Souza at number 4 with his book, The Roots of Obama's Rage. Basically, he argues that Obama is an anti-colonialist, anti-American. And down at number 6, we've got Bill O'Reilly with Pinheads and Patriots. Basically, he argues that Obama is a pinhead.
And not a patriot, presumably.
I don't think so. And I haven't finished the book yet. Down at number 10, David Limbaugh still hanging on with Crimes Against Liberty, and we know who the criminal is in this instance. If Obama sort of loses big in the midterms, he may be able to take some solace from the book that enters at number 3 this week. It's Tucker Max's book, politely called Jerks Finish First.
Speaking of Afghanistan, what about the book the Pentagon tried to suppress? They found an unusual way to deal with this.
Yes,
book.
This is Anthony. Well, you know how we have a little dagger next to titles on the list that have shown a lot of bulk sales, usually political books bought by various interest groups? Well, I'm wondering if we should introduce another symbol to, you know, books that have been given a big boost by government-funded shredding operations. Anthony Schaefer's Operation Darkheart made news last month. This is an inside first-person view of intelligence special ops in Afghanistan. It was vetted by the Pentagon, but then they decided that they didn't like it. So it was reported last month that they tried to buy up all 10,000 copies of the first print run to keep it out of the hands of the public. This is sort of a pretty clumsy strategy that actually ended up giving the book a lot of news attention, and this week it lands at number 7 on the list.
Has that ever happened before?
I think I know of at least one precedent. Back in 1964, a writer named David Wise published a book called The Invisible Government. It was about the CIA, and the CIA explored the possibility of buying up all the books. And Bennett Cerf, the CEO of Random House, said, great, go for it. We'll just print more.
Publishers, there's your new potential sales.
Seriously.
Make some people nervous in the government. They'll buy up all the copies of your book. Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.